Welcome to the ACRL Files. Our listeners know that the American College of Real Estate Lawyers is a national organization of just over 1,000 distinguished practitioners around the country, fostering the exchange of the most sophisticated ideas and experiences in the development, financing, and investment in real estate. We continue our series of podcasts today with leading individuals in commercial real estate who have built the companies that have shaped the industry, to share their reflections on their careers and predictions for the future. Today, I am quite pleased to welcome Tony Malkin, the chairman and CEO of the Empire State Realty Trust. And we will hear much about that today. Tony, thanks for joining me.
Nice to be here.
So before we chat about all the interesting things that I know you've been doing at ESRT and lots, let's sort of start a little bit back from the beginning and tell us about where you were born, where you grew up, went to school, and how you got in the real estate industry.
Okay, well, I'll let you break that into whatever pieces you like. I will tell you that I was born in New York City, and I grew up in Greenwich, Connecticut, youngest of three. Ultimately, I found my way to Harvard College, from which I graduated with honors in English. Never went to graduate school.
Right. And then your family was obviously in the real estate business. Did you start out initially in real estate with your English degree?
I did not. I actually started out in the private equity business. I started with a firm called Chemical Venture Partners. Chemical Venture Partners was the Chemical New York, old Chemical Bank, now JPMorgan Chase. Yeah. And that was the holding company was the limited partner. And then the general partner was a fellow who was one of my very early bosses, mentors, and is actually currently lead director of our public company, a fellow named Steve Gilbert. And that was where I got my business education. I started work there in 1985. I didn't join with my family until 1989.
And when you moved over to your family business, what were you focusing on in the beginning, and how did you, really get comfortable in the real estate world?
So my grandfather, Lawrence Ween, my mom's dad, passed on December 10 of 1988. He had cancer, and it was clear that he was going to pass. My brother had worked during his combined JD-MBA commuting back and forth to New York on a small family property business we had called W&M Capital. He later renamed it W&M Properties, and I later renamed it Malkin Properties. But W&M Capital was run by my brother, and I came to the conclusion after some conversations with my parents that in their view, he would run that activity. So I said, I thought I'd do something else. In November of 88, my brother and my dad decided to part ways. My brother's very interested in development. He's had a fantastic career, has created the Bicester Village collection of luxury shopping villages, nine in Europe, two in China, one that just opened at UBS Arena, next to his arena out in Belmont Park. And my dad asked if I would join him to help sort some things through after my grandfather's passing. What I didn't realize I would sort through was the savings and loan crisis that really had the die for which was set with the aggressive tax deductions people could get from real estate development in the 1980s, and the continued legislative tightening of those tax benefits created a huge overhang of I would say ill-conceived, improperly financed, or just impacted by the market, or, as we like to say, D, all of the above, real estate developments. And from 1989 through 1992, we saw closures of savings and loans. We saw the creation of the Resolution Trust Company. And so for me, that was my education in real estate. What you might call me a depression baby from that perspective. And when I started work with my dad, it was to assist him. And we went through a lot of things together as I took the business education I had received working in private equity and applied a lot of those lessons to real estate. And you know, well, I'll let you ask whatever else you might like to ask, but that was the start of it. And I will say that after when I started, I said to my dad I would give him 3 years of transition time, then I'd go back to the private equity business. And towards the end of 3 years, he said, "I'd like you to stay," and we had a conversation on what basis I would, and then I stayed.
That worked out pretty well for both of you, it looks like.
Well, it did. You know, by the way, I had during that period of time what I call my Scarlett O'Hara moment, where I, you know, if you recall the scene from Gone with the Wind, she said, "As God is my witness, I'll never go hungry again." my comment was, "As God is my witness, we'll never be so concentrated, illiquid, with personal guarantees, you know, ever again." So it was a process to get through all that.
Right.
And as far as concentration, that also meant that by 1993, we had commenced to invest outside of real estate. And that is by far the bigger component of our family activities today, is the activity outside of real estate.
Okay. But let's stay focused on real estate, because I mean, I want to talk a lot about how you transform the company. Of course, you know, people think, oh, Empire State Realty Trust, that's the Empire State Building. But it's much more, right? And when did that diversification start? Back, you know, in the 90s or more recently?
Now, the business really was created by my grandfather. My great-grandfather, our great-grandfather, came over in 1882, 12 years old, alone, answered the questions wrong at the Battery. So he became Joseph Wien from Pinsky instead of Joseph Pinsky from Vienna. He went to work in Paterson, New Jersey as a spindle monkey. He had relatives in Paterson, New Jersey. Paterson, New Jersey was the silk weaving capital of the world at that point. And they employed young boys, small young boys, to climb around the tops of the machines to put fresh spindles of spools of silk on there when they needed replacement, and to run them through the machines so the machines would run powered by water from the river there in the falls. And, you know, over time, he became a salesman. Over time, he took the customers and he formed his own company. And over time, he had a number of silk mills. And he took the profits from those businesses and put them into second mortgages of small residential buildings. Our grandfather, Lawrence A. Wien, so named because his father wanted him to become a lawyer, and the initials spelled law, he actually was a lawyer and was put in charge from the crash to keep these properties in the depression, to keep these properties from the banks. He said, "Look, you don't know what to do with these things. We'll run them. We'll give you all the cash that comes out of them. And when things sort out, we'll resolve the loans. In the meantime, you know, why, you know, put these things on your balance sheet?" And that was the start of the real estate business, because he came to the determination that his family had saved the savings that they had made, preserved them through real estate, and he felt that every person should have, as part of estate planning, as part of retirement planning, as part of diversification from their businesses or practices or whatever service they provided through which they received money, an investment in real estate. And that was the creation of real estate syndication, where he innovated in as much as he created a format through which flow through tax treatment could be achieved. So you could invest as a group and not be taxed at a corporate level. So all of that created over time a tremendous number of deals that were done. My father joined my grandfather in 1958 after he graduated from Harvard Law School, and they ran the business out of the law firm at the time. And when we look at how things actually worked, Empire State Realty Trust is sort of the, you know, what we held on to and thought worth holding on to through all of the issues we had over time. My grandfather wanted to give money away to charity so he would sell things. Then we had issues with Leona Helmsley after his partner Harry Helmsley died. And then the formation of Empire State Realty Trust was really a resolution of diverse ownership structures and separate balance sheets to come up with one modern governance structure and one cohesive and coherent balance sheet. And it actually worked out very well. It was not a simple process. I've glossed over what was, you know, from 1995 to 2013. And I started in 89. So I sort of think from 1989 to 2013, I did workouts and restructurings, you know. Bought additional properties, and reinvigorated the syndication program and process for our business. And that was part of the diversification effort to put our money into other things while continue to practice in real estate. And did a number of good deals and made a bunch of money for ourselves and our investors.
So as you've seen lots of cycles, right, in New York City and every place else. And you know, the Empire State Building is a poster child maybe for a, you know, building developed a long time ago that you and your team have managed to reposition, keep positioned as a, you know, terrific location. And I know from chats at the Real Estate Rant Type and other places, all the things that you've done, but talk a little bit about how you envisioned bringing that building into the future.
Well, it was a 9-year litigation between ourselves and Mrs. Helmsley, and different properties came under our control at different points along the way. And when we finally achieved resolution with the Empire State Building and took over the day-to-day operation of the building, it was like any of the other buildings that had been involved in those partnerships. Not a lot of debt on it, number one. Number two, a somewhat interesting structure. There was a group that owned the master lease when my grandfather acquired the building with my dad. They sold the land as part of that financing structure to the Prudential Insurance Company. So in exchange for a 125-year lease. So the ownership of the land and the building had always been separated. And then they took the land, the master lease they had, and they syndicated that in 3,000 units of $10,000 each. And then they formed a separate operating lease group to operate the building. And that consisted of my grandfather, Harry Helmsley, and a few other partners who had helped finance the acquisition of the building in the first place, because the syndication took quite some time to sell. Mm-hmm. $30 million of interests in 1961, 1962 was quite a lot of money. So when we got control of the building in 2006, they had 752 individual suites, The average fully escalated rent was $26.50 per occupied square foot. The observatory was just a line that snaked through the building lobby, and you went through back halls, chaopectate green, with vending machines put there by people who worked for Mrs. Helmsley, and they decided they owned the pathway, so they put their own vending machines in to sell sodas and candy. There was a renovation of the building lobby in order to put in a new fire control station, and they put the chips of stone in small boxes and sold them as pieces of the Empire State Building you could buy. The whole thing was quite amazing. And it was sort of like going into, on the outside, of course, it was glorious. And on the inside, it was sort of a smoldering wet dumpster where you had to peel the pages of books and garments and furniture that had been tossed in there apart and clean it up. Those suites were occupied by hat band companies, belts, hosiery, handbags, all sorts of travel agents and nanny agencies and employment agencies and a couple of not-for-profits. And then one or two tenants who occupied one floor or more in the textile business. You know, it started out as the headquarters of DuPont back in the day. And it had never really achieved success. So we decided to start what we called the Empire State Rebuilding Program. And when it came time to do that, we looked at a sale of the building at the time. And we consulted on that with Mrs. Helmsley, because we shared vetoes over the operating lease. We controlled the master lease group. And we ended up with a couple of things. At one point in the early 1990s, we had a chance to buy the land under the building. And Mrs. Helmsley said, yeah, you do that, we'll sue. And while that discussion went on, someone else bought it. It was a matter of taking all of these disparate pieces in 1995 and through that effort by 2006, we had devised a program where we would, number one, start the Empire State Rebuilding. Number two, we would consolidate floors. Number three, we would clean it up. We got rid of all the asbestos, any hot water, cold water, wastewater risers that needed to be, which needed to be replaced, we replaced. We redid the lobby. It took us 5 months longer to redo the lobby than it took to rebuild to build the building in the first place. We had to go through landmarks and get all those approvals. Little things like we redid the lighting in the lobby to the original specification when the building was originally built, and suddenly this harsh red and gray lobby, all of the subtle tones of the stone came back through. And we redid the ceiling mural that had been covered over with fluorescent lights and plastic lenses. And we went about things in a fashion that we decided to make energy efficiency and sustainability one of the cornerstones of the building, in an effort to do something that in which, number one, we believed, and number two, we thought would reposition the building. Because the building, well, now it's in the middle of everything, and it was always in the middle of everything, surrounded by mass transit, great commutation access, middle of Manhattan there at 34th and 5th. It had become known as the middle of nowhere over time, and you couldn't get good brokers to bring good tenants to the building. So it's a very long answer, but in short, you know, we now sign leases that begin in the high eights. I think by the end of this year, we'll sign leases that begin with a nine. The building's 95.5% leased. We completely redid the observatory, $165 million project. put in a designated dedicated entrance on the at street level to the building. So we got those people out of the building lobby. We've redone the retail. So, oh, retail, you know, is always a work in progress, but we have we've done had a lot of successes there and amenitized it. It's I can go into more if you like, but it's a great success, probably the best success it's ever been in its history.
And you said there were 700 plus tenants back when you started that sort of transformation. Is the mix of tenants changed different dramatically?
Yes, it has. Yeah, we have tenants, which are 500,000 square feet, 250,000 square feet. It's the largest office of LinkedIn on the East Coast, New York City. I'm not sure if it's the largest office in the world or not. I've never checked on that. LinkedIn started as a very small subtenant of an architecture firm when it was a startup company. It had a few thousand square feet on one floor, and now they occupy over 500,000 square feet. Yes, it's changed quite a lot. We have J.C. Deco, the outdoor advertising business, North American headquarters, STV, a giant design build engineering firm controlled by the Pritzker organization. We've got law firms of multiple floors. We've got other engineering firms. Skanska's offices are there. Booking Holdings. You name it. We've got it. It's a fantastic, high credit quality tenant roster.
Good for you. So you touched on this. You were a pioneer in thinking about the importance of sustainability and energy issues. And I know that's part of the story here, and you've been a leader in the industry on it at the Roundtable and other places. So talk a little bit about how that is impacting real estate, particularly in a place like New York City, where you've got such a high concentration of older buildings.
Well, all our buildings are older buildings. Our youngest building at this point approaches 80 years old. So meaning in our portfolio. And our portfolio's hallmarks are modernized, amenitized, energy efficient, great sustainability practices, and of course we've got a great balance sheet. So we're top of tier in our price range. We're over 94% leased in our portfolio. And we've had over three consecutive years to increase percentage leased and increased mark to markets on leases. So with that in mind, our whole thing is about what we do to repurpose and redevelop assets. And that's a great skill we have. I think a lot of people look at how to do that on paper. We've done it in concrete and steel and brick and stone. What we find is that number one, it is a great brand for our work. Number two, it's of great benefit to our tenants because everything we do has an economic basis. Everything that we do is based on investment and return. And the tenants benefit from that. We've pioneered how to design and execute energy efficient tenant installations. And it's modestly more expensive to do, but the payback in energy savings is anywhere from 3 to 5 years. And when you sign 10 to 15 year leases, that actually means that as a tenant who pays the electricity and power is the third biggest expense after rent and salary, power is the greatest expense that a tenant, a company has to bear. And so if you reduce the exposure to consumption, you reduce their exposure to expense. And energy prices in the United States have only gone up and will only continue to go up. The demand and the sources combined together, along with the inadequacies of the grid, to require significant additional investment in today dollars to manufacture more electricity. And that drives rates up. So when we do our analyses, we don't forward project the costs, and nor when we explain things to tenants of the benefits of an energy efficient tenant installation and execution and operation, do we forward price the power? And nonetheless, it makes massive economic sense. So, and by the way, the other stuff we do, waste diversion, reduction in water consumption, all of these things have terrific economic benefit, and it's part of brand. You know, we don't do it initially to comply with law. It just so happens that under Local Law 97, you know, our tenants won't be exposed to fines because we have helped them design in order to be efficient to the extent that they won't experience fines. And by the way, as you know, Jay, might as well get out there, everything we do, we publish for free and share. So some people ask, well, why do you do that? And say, well, you know, I'm interested to change the world, number one. And number two, we get first mover advantage all the time. So our brand is unique in that it represents the ability to handle things in just a better way. And other people can follow us, but they're followers. They're not originators.
I mean, it's an extraordinary story, right? When you say that your youngest building is 80 years old, right? When you listen
nearly
80 years old, okay? And that's one of, you've got almost, what, 10 million square feet, right? And you're at 94%.
Just under 8 million square feet of office.
Okay.
94. We've got retail and multifamily in there as well.
Right. 94% leased in a world where we hear all the time
more than 94%.
Oh, more than
Go ahead. I'll just keep
okay.
editing.
Okay. That's okay. I'm good with that. But you know, we read about and hear about, right, is the so-called flight to quality, right? Going over to Hudson Yards in Manhattan West and, you know, all the new buildings and the challenges that, you know, we would expect that are faced by the older buildings. And that, you know, when I hear reports, like I went to a seminar back in, you know, I don't know, November, and talking about the vacancy percentages and, you know, by different kinds of buildings, you know, oh, well, the trophy buildings are, you know, 90 to 95%, maybe higher, right? And as you drop down, this was in DC, to the B and C buildings, the numbers were dramatically lower. And I'm sure there's plenty of buildings like that in New York City as well. But you guys have accomplished this amazing transformation of these older buildings for all the reasons you said, because they're economically so attractive and in great locations like Grand Central and Broadway, where you've got stuff every place. It's really sort of the story that people wouldn't expect unless they, you know, were really paying attention.
Well, you know, we became part of and we're on the vanguard of the flight to quality, just in our tier. So, you know, and we've been able to raise our rents. So as new construction, brand new, goes $150, $200 a square foot.
Right.
There's a lot of room for us.
Right.
To raise our rent.
How do you define your tier? Right.
The tenants to whom we lease. So part of what I do is I use my business background to assess the risk of our tenants. We have full-time credit analysts, bank credit analysts, who underwrite the credit of every tenant to whom we lease. And that helps dictate A, whether or not we'll accept them at all, and B, what amount of security will require. But that doesn't help dictate, it does dictate. And those, that discipline is something that really other landlords simply don't do. And that's because of my background and my history from business, you know? And so I look at this from a business perspective. I look at our tenants, and we realize that over time since 2013, we've signed over 3 million square feet of new leases with existing tenants. So out of our 8 million square foot portfolio, more than one third of the leases we've signed since 2013 are with existing tenants who expanded. And over time, what's happened in the brokerage community and amongst other tenants is they learn, wow, this is where LinkedIn chose to be. This is where Institutional Capital Network chose to be. The Institutional Capital Network's more than a 200,000 square foot tenant at One Grand Central Place. One Grand Central Place never had in its history, going back to the late 1920s, an over 200,000 square foot tenant. When we look at, we've mentioned LinkedIn, when we look at Burlington, the retailer, 1400 Broadway, yep, they have expanded and expanded and expanded again. Now, they paid more as they have signed new leases. And yet, in order for someone to pay less, you have to go to a much, much, much lower quality building. Mm-hmm. And in order to go brand new, you have to pay much, much, much,
much more. Much more, right.
And then the brand and the service, we have a hospitality approach as a landlord. So the brand and the service that we created, we in our most recent leases at One Grand Central Place have received higher rents than Vornado and SL Green have received at 100 Park and 90 Park for large leases they just signed. Our rents are higher. Those are glass box, quote, modern buildings, unquote. And we've achieved higher rents. So part of its brand, it's modernization, it's amenitization, it's the hospitality service approach. It's our balance sheet, it's our locations, and it's the reputation as in the flight to quality. We are absolutely top of tier in our price point.
Got it. So let's just switch a little bit. So it's now 2025. We're five, as all the articles have been recently coming out, we're 5 years since COVID. I will say, I know you travel plenty, but my travels show me for sure that New York is in a much stronger position than DC, Chicago, San Francisco, right? And there's lots of reasons for that. But we'll talk about the challenges of the, you know, return to office and what you've seen and how comfortable, confident you are that New York's in a really good place and, you know, going forward, the office market and the urban environment is going to continue strong.
So I would say, by the way, that we're in New York City in better shape than Phoenix, Austin, Houston, Miami, Charlotte, even Atlanta. And the reason I say that is that unique for New York is that it is a lure for talent. It is where the young people, more than any other city, want to come to work. Mm-hmm. They want to come to work. They want to come to learn. They want to come to associate with other really smart people. They want to experience the culture, the nightlife. It's where they want to meet their partners, and where they want to date. And so New York has that attribute. New York is the only capital of culture and commerce that's not the capital of a country anywhere in the world.
Right.
Number one. Number two, New York is by its nature a confined space. And if you look at what's happened in the Smile States, I call it the Phoenixification of these smaller cities. It's just sprawl. And the lure might be a lifestyle, affordability. In the end, though, it all turns into sprawl. And the sprawl is managed with automobiles. So we're very fortunate in New York City. And as far as the return to work.
Return to office. You know,
well, I no, I actually call it return to work. You know, as far as return to doing one job, as opposed to be at home as a gig worker, and on the one hand, and hold the job on another. There's a large company that audited about 2 years after COVID and discovered that a number of its employees had more than one health plan, and realized that a number of its remote employees actually had two jobs. So the return to work, if you want to add in the office, is very real. And I think the story is over. It's been, at least in New York City, it's been written. And what's been written is these young kids want to come where they can learn. They don't come to stay in a small apartment with a bunch of roommates and work remotely. And they go to the companies where their superiors, to whom they report, are in the office and can assign them work. And as you know from the legal business, there are a whole slew of fifth year associates out there who have at best 2 years worth of experience. And I'll never forget the statistic I heard from 2022 is it was one of the highest billing of hours in the history of the legal profession. And it was also the highest number of hours credited to clients in the history of the legal profession for bad work, for work that was, where excessive hours were put in because no one's sitting there next to you. No one sits there next to you with an opportunity to learn. So, and by the way, that fifth year associate vintage 2020 is probably worth less than a 2 year associate from 2022 who worked in the office from the moment they arrived with mentoring and learning. And without any of the whole attitude about, you know, oh, I got to go to the office. Without any of the attitude of the loss of the perk. So New York benefits from this. Now, I won't say that there aren't a number of businesses out there who are still virtual and involve gig working to some extent. An awful lot of coders and programmers still work remotely. At the same time, those who work in the office, and we get a lot of exposure of this through some of our tenants in the who are involved in different aspects of technology. The engineers and coders who work in the office are happier and more productive than the ones who are remote. and that they respond to innovation and exchange of ideas with better productivity. So that said, you know, just the same way as I wouldn't rent to WeWork for shared office spaces, you know, I don't think that the work from home thing is a sign of a healthy economy.
Agreed. So you've dealt with lots of brokers, lawyers, outside advisors. You know, our audience would be interested in how you would best describe, you know, the people who are really good at providing advice to companies like yours.
You know, early on, when I was scraping two sticks together in the real estate business, when my family was probably 120% invested in real estate and had no other investments, we started to come up with this concept of full service to our buildings and our tenants. We call it what we call it today, turnkey services. And that included construction. And I'll never forget when we first went and went for a contract, to sign a contract for one of our first interior jobs done outside of our portfolio. And the lawyer working on the contract, the fellow who was started this business for me, Tom Durrells, who's still been with ESRT, been with me for more than three decades. He said, I can't get the contract done. I said, what do you mean? I said, you know, the attorney's asking for all of these clauses, which, you know, are not in the market, which the client won't accept. And I got on the phone with the attorney and I said, you know, what's up? And the person explained to me all the risks. And I said, so basically what you've told me is you think this is too risky a business to do. There's too much risk in this business. Not only shouldn't we do this contract, we shouldn't do contracting. To which the attorney replied, well, yes. To which I replied, well, I didn't ask you to tell me whether or not I should do the business. I asked for you to help us get a contract signed. We made the decision to go into the business. And now I don't want to work with you anymore. And who would? If you make that kind of a business judgment for me. Now, that person had never had any experience drafting contracts for interior demolition and construction work. On the other hand, you go to the people who have had experience, and that's why it's so important for lawyers to be in the office with other people with experience, because you make other people's hindsight your foresight. And that's what I look for in a good attorney. Someone who's done a lot of business, has seen a lot of different activities, and particularly when we have to try something new or innovative, has the library of experience from which to draw. And what have lenders accepted? What have CMBS originators accepted? What's the difference between this CMBS originator and this one in what they're prepared to do? And how much is it worth in basis points for the flexibility? You know, how much is it worth it to take the risk on this point in this acquisition? Okay, we haven't negotiated the right to do core drilling in a slab. Okay, but is that really needed in order to do this contract? Then we sign the contract, and later we say, look, we would like to do before the closing some core drilling in the slab because we have a defined scope of work we want to do. And if we can do this core drilling earlier, then we'll have the opportunity to go to work sooner and have less carry time without productivity economically of the space in the building that we're buying. You know, so to me, it's the people who can advise and the people who've had good experience, people who are businesslike, and most important of all, people who can write, people who can draft. And there are two areas of drafting to me which are important. One is the world of drafting with passive verbs, with ing verbs, the documents which exist as a state of being rather than as actions to be taken. Lack of clarity due to poor drafting to me is inexcusable. Never use more words. We're not dealing with Dickens here or Melville. We're not getting paid by the word.
Right.
So I'll pay more for better documents, which are well written, direct and to the point. Number one. And number two, very importantly, I remember working with one attorney, Howard Peskill, in case he listens in on this, he's long retired. And whenever economics were cited in documents, he would write out the actual mathematical formulae on a piece of paper, and then he would draft. He would look at the formulae, and if you don't know how to say things where the denominator is X and the numerator is Y, and if you don't understand how all these different pieces work together, clear drafting without passive verbs and economics, which are written out and then drafted, if you can't read a document, easily write a mathematical formula, it's a poorly written document.
Great advice. I agree with you. Look, I could talk to you for many, many hours longer, and I really appreciate the time you've given us. Let me just close with one last question for you. In your very accomplished career over the years, what's the best business advice you've received?
Wow. Huh. You know, my first boss was a very difficult person. He is still rather difficult. He's my lead director right now. He was a lot more difficult when he was younger. And he's also very smart. And I learned a couple of things from him. One of the most important things I learned from him is to have an open mind. You have to have the right mix of ideas and wisdom. Let's not confuse knowledge with ideas. Knowledge is the outcome of experience. Ideas are the outcome of a creative mind. Apply that to business and to say, all right, we can take what we've gone through by experience, then we can discount a lot of different ideas up with which people come. However, to be too settled in to this is the way we do it, and not to recognize that new ideas come up all the time, that combination of existing prior experience can be put together with new developments in law or technology or just creativity and different ways to create a new product. You know, it's not we do it because that's the way we do it. It's we do it that way because it's the best way we have found to do it so far. And the corollary to this in my book is there's only so much you can do. Sometimes you have to stop from the execution of things in one way in order to create the space to do something new. Only so many hours in the day.
Correct.
Use your hours wisely, right? So, and be creative, have an open mind, have a good balance sheet, a good governance structure, work with good attorneys. You got a fighting chance.
Great. Tony, thank you very much for your time and for your insights. We really appreciate it.
Hey, Jay, it's a real pleasure. Thanks for taking the time and thanks for inviting me aboard.
Great.
Cheers.